Greetings, this is Roger Kimball, the editor and publisher of the New Criterion. I'm speaking to you today from a semi-secure, undisclosed location not too far from our world headquarters in New York City. It's my pleasure to bring you, a little late, our June 2023 issue, which, as always, is jam-packed with things that you will not want to miss. This month, we start off things with an extraordinary essay by the entrepreneur and public intellectual Peter Thiel. It is a version of the talk he gave at our annual Edmund Burke Award dinner in April. It's called The Diversity Myth, and the combination of those two words, diversity and myth, begin to tell you what that essay is all about. And when I tell you that it ends by noting that, and I quote, it would be healthier that whenever someone mentions DEI, you just think CCP. There you go. Many thanks to Peter Thiel for being our honoree at the Edmund Burke Award dinner this year, and thanks in particular for this fine essay. Elsewhere in the June 2023 issue, we have our managing editor Benjamin Riley reporting from Amsterdam on a new show about Vermeer. It's a terrific piece. You won't want to miss that. And we have a letter from London by Simon Heffer, who was there to see the coronation of King Charles III. Who would have predicted that? There are many other fine things in the June 2023 issue, including an extraordinary essay by our poetry critic, Adam Kirsch, on the opera by Hans Pfitzner called Palestrina. I have to admit that I had not heard that, and I was very enlightened to read Adam's piece. Nor will you want to miss the fine review essay by the great Glenn Elmers of Hadley Arkus's new book on natural law. It's a very thoughtful review essay, and once again, I was enlightened to read it. There are also, of course, the essays by our regular columnists, theater by Kyle Smith, art by Karen Wilkin, and our own executive editor, James Panero, the media by James Bowman, our semi-annual Verse Chronicle by William Logan, and much, much more. Perhaps this is the place also to mention that our visiting critics next season will be Wilfred McClay, the author of Land of Hope, An Invitation to the Great American Story, an extraordinary history of the United States that is, even as I speak, supplanting the rather poisonous Marxist-inspired History of the United States by Howard Zinn, that, having sold some 5 million copies, I believe, has poisoned the minds of generations of high school students. Bill McClay's book was a welcome antidote to that very influential and very malevolent textbook. And joining us once again next year will be Victor Davis Hanson, our second visiting critic, and we're delighted to have both Victor and Bill McClay joining us for our next season. Now, let me read to you our notes and comments from June 2023. There are two of them, and the first is called Urban Nightmare. Longtime readers may recall our fondness for Kingsley Amis's observation that nice things are nicer than nasty ones. You might think that such a proposition is close to what philosophers call an analytic truth, a tautology. Just as all bachelors are unmarried is necessarily true because bachelor simply means unmarried male. So, nice things are nicer than nasty ones is true because, by definition, nice things are the opposite of nasty ones, or so one might have thought. The surreal nature of our social life today often inverts the most taken-for-granted and common truths. We won't travel down the perilous paths indicated by words like married, bachelor, or, God help us, male, except to note that the apparently unsettled nature of such words today may say more about the corrosive linguistic influence of Humpty Dumpty than about reality itself. "When I use a word," the egg told Alice, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." Alice, a level-headed girl that she was, coolly replied, "The question is whether you can make words mean so many different things." That ought to have shut up Humpty Dumpty, but he came back with a response that Plato's Thrasymachus or O'Brien in Orwell's 1984 would have admired. "The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be master? That's all." What prompted us to rehearse these observations was an exhibition called 29 Million Dreams. On view last month at a pop-up museum at 216 Lafayette Street in Manhattan, this entertainment brought together work by some 75 artists and, let me supply editorial quotes around the word artists, to question the success of so-called broken windows policing. The figure 29 million was chosen because, according to the organizers of the exhibition, New York spends $29 million per day on its police force. Just think of how all that money might be put to better use. This is the second go-round for this curious exhibition. Its first iteration was back in 2018. It returned last month, with an extended run, no less, to investigate what, quote, toll broken windows policing has had on black and brown New Yorkers, end quote. As it happens, that is an easy question to answer. Broken windows policing, as pioneered in New York by then-Mayor Rudolph Giuliani in the 1990s, benefited all New Yorkers, black, brown, ivory, pink, yellow, and albino. Indeed, it ranks among the most successful and humane police initiatives in recent memory. Almost overnight, the police began to intervene against the squeegee men who harassed motorists traveling in and out of the city, the vandals who defaced buildings with graffiti, the drug addicts and prostitutes who loitered in public places plying their trade, and the fare jumpers in the subway. Those interventions materially improved the urban fabric of the city. Taking care of the little things, it transpired, affected big things like burglary, mugging, rape, and other assaults. Within months, the city was cleaner and more hospitable. Violent crime plummeted, and New York went from being one of the most dangerous and unpleasant cities in the country, under Giuliani's incompetent predecessor, David Dinkins, to being one of the safest and most vibrant. That transformation was analyzed expertly by the late Fred Siegel, who died last month in his brilliant study of Giuliani and his era, The Prince of the City. The organizers of 29 Million Dreams, a repellent specimen of an encephalic reflexive leftism, describe broken windows policing as, quote, an outdated policing strategy that belongs in a museum rather than on our streets, end quote. But the disastrous anti-cop legacy of Bill de Blasio, continued in essentials by the current mayor, Eric Adams, and his many relatives on the city payroll, shows that this gets things exactly backward. The homeless are everywhere on the streets now. Buildings are routinely defaced. Garbage, trash, and human excrement litter the pavement. Violent crime is soaring. Why? Because the police are prevented from doing their job by do-gooder liberals and anti-white race hustlers. The organizers of this exhibition echo previous complaints by activists that Eric Adams' proposed budget, quote, prioritizes violent policing over other community programs facing severe cuts, like libraries, end quote. But the truth is that broken windows policing is the opposite of violent policing. It starts with manners and etiquette, understanding that if you encourage people to follow bourgeois norms regarding cleanliness and a basic respect for property, they are much less likely to behave badly in other avenues of their lives. As for libraries, the sad truth is that precisely because of the abandonment of broken windows policing, those sheltered spaces are havens for the homeless and drug addicted more than they are resources for the scholarly and intellectually curious. The idea behind 29 Million Dreams is not only misguided, it is also stale. As Heather MacDonald shows in her book, The War on Cops, first published in 2016, the racially tinged campaign against broken windows policing goes back to its origin in the 1990s. The detractors of broken windows policies and cognate prophylactic techniques, such as the practice of stopping and frisking suspicious individuals, face one huge obstacle. Such practices are stunningly effective in reducing crime. As MacDonald points out, their implementation in New York, quote, catapulted the city far ahead of the competition. New York's crime drop far exceeded the national norm in degree and duration. It's hard to find a police chief around the country who doesn't advocate broken windows policing because commanders see with their own eyes its value in lowering crime and disorder, end quote. In sum, broken windows policing has, quote, saved thousands of black lives, brought lawful commerce and jobs to once drug-infested neighborhoods, and allowed millions to go about their daily lives without fear. End that quotation from Heather MacDonald. The organizers of 29 Million Dreams pretend that the broken windows policing took a sad toll on New York City. In fact, its abandonment transformed the dream of urban comity into a rancid nightmare. Humpty Dumpty would have been proud of their effrontery. A word of thanks. We are pretty sure that one of the first phrases in Latin one learns is conditio sine qua non, the condition without which not. That is, the thing without which the enterprise in question could not succeed. For several years now, we have employed this space at the end of our season to pay homage to those individuals and entities without whom the new criterion could not succeed. This minor act of what Virgil called pietas confronts us with a task that is even more gratifying than it is imperative. For one thing, it affords us an opportunity to look back to many engagements during the year when we were brought together with members of our extended family of New Criterion stalwarts. How many ideas and initiatives were born and nurtured during those conversations? Writing this also allows us to indulge in the often underestimated pleasure of declaring our pride at and gratitude for the heavy votes of confidence our work has elicited. By and large, supporters of the New Criterion are also enthusiasts for the work accomplished and the world view espoused by this intellectual and literary adventure. As Abraham Lincoln is alleged to have said in another context, for people who like this sort of thing, the New Criterion is the sort of thing they like. Not everyone is pleased, of course. From before our very first issue, way back in September 1982, the New Criterion has conducted its march through the cultural landscape, accompanied by what Edmund Burke called the importunate chink of more or less rabid detractors. We were too elitist, too traditionalist, too conservative to be allowed a place at the table of civilized cultural exchange. It is true that we thrive partly because of our enemies. Their silly obloquy calls attention to our virtues. But we exist at all because our friends acknowledge the importance of what we do with their support. And here we are, more than 40 years later. How did that happen? It happened because our supporters have understood and approved of our work, defending civilization, open debate, and the pursuit of truth. As we have observed before in this space, the new criterion exists only because our extended, and we are happy to say growing, family of readers demonstrate by their support that they want us to exist. We take no government money and never have. We depend absolutely on those of you who subscribe and donate to the magazine. You make our monthly publication as well as our vibrant online presence possible. In recent years, we have expanded our activities to include conferences, symposia, recitals, and other gatherings. We would not have been able to do this without your help. We are particularly grateful to those who created and sustained the new criterion in its early years. We would like to mention in particular the late lamented John M. Olin Foundation, as well as the Sarah Scaife Foundation and the Lined and Harry Bradley Foundation, which have been critical supporters for more than four decades. Our late friend Donald Kahn intervened to help us with major support at a parlous moment. In addition to these founding benefactors, we are proud to name other individuals and entities that have stepped forward to support us with major gifts this year. We want to mention in particular Elizabeth Ailes, Mary Ellen Bork, the Carson Meyer Charitable Foundation, the William H. Donner Foundation, the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation, Ira D. and Joe Ellen Terrell, the Gale Foundation, the Hickory Foundation, Paul J. Isaac, the Kleinschmidt Family Foundation, the Thomas D. Klingenstein Fund, Christopher Laconi, Ron and Joe Carroll Lauder, the Leggett Foundation, the Marcus Foundation, the Fred Maytag Family Foundation, the Diane Graves Owen Foundation, David Packard, Don and Donna Riley, the Thomas W. Smith Foundation, the Diana Davis Spencer Foundation, the Triad Foundation, Ida Walters, and the late J. W. Henry Watson, and Helen Zell. To this distinguished list, we would like to add the name of that prolific philanthropist, author, artist, and composer, Anonymous, who has also manned the battlements in defense of culture and for our benefit. Thank you all for your friendship and support this past year. Together, you really are the conditio sine qua non of our efforts. We are deeply grateful for your help, and we look forward to many more years of fruitful collaboration. See you in September.